Yes, we completed a study looking at the sexual and reproductive health literacy needs in one online social network, myself, my co-authors, Rudith Lane and Dr. Cheryl Vamos. I have no relationships to disclose. So health literacy is the process or the ability to find, understand, evaluate, and use information in order to make health-related decisions, to perform health-related behaviors and activities, and also to interact with the healthcare system. And finding information is this first step in the health literacy process, and it's also often called health information seeking behavior. So this is important because many individuals do not have access to accurate sexual and reproductive health information, particularly among young people. And this leads to inconsistent contraceptive use, unintended pregnancy, and of course, sexually transmitted infection rates. And it's important because sexual and reproductive health is key to informed decision-making about how to consistently correctly use contraceptive methods to prevent unintended pregnancy and sexually transmitted infection. And unfortunately, many individuals get this information from poor sources, like their peers and like the internet. They turn to these sources because they may not have access to healthcare providers, or if they do have access to healthcare providers, they often may feel embarrassed about asking those providers, you know, these questions about their sex lives, about preventing pregnancy, about STIs. And so they turn to the internet. They do this for a couple reasons. The internet is convenient. We're probably all walking around with phones in our pockets where it's just so easy to access a wealth of information. It's anonymous, so that embarrassment sort of issue can go away. It also helps them in order to support their decision-making needs, as well as provides a diversity of different types of information that may not be traditionally available in other areas. So what our group did is we looked at one popular social network microblogging platform, which is Tumblr. And in Tumblr, you can make posts of text, pictures, audio, and video material. And it comprises about 258 million different unique blogs, 121 billion posts. And Tumblr users tend to be female, they tend to be non-white, young, and they tend to be low income. And Tumblr creates sort of this sense of community, and users are likely to follow blogs that have similar interests and views similar to their own. And it's also a place that people may seek out information. In addition to these individual bloggers, major health organizations also have Tumblr pages, including the American Cancer Society, Planned Parenthood, and many state and local health departments. Very little research has been conducted in regards to Tumblr and health issues, and of those that have been, they're most likely, they tend to be clustered around disordered eating and nutrition issues. So we looked at one blog run by a small group of credentialed healthcare professionals that answered sexual and reproductive health questions. And we did a qualitative content analysis around this blog. And we looked at all the question and answer pairs for an 18-month period. And that resulted in 326 individual different questions. And what we were really looking at were sort of trends in the question content to find what are people looking for answers about. So if we look at who asked the questions, well, we know very little because about 80% of the individuals asking questions did so anonymously. On Tumblr, you have the option of asking a question of a blog and clicking, you know, I want to do this anonymously. In the questions, about 58% provided some sort of medical information, like I'm 12 weeks pregnant, or I have polycystic ovarian syndrome, and only about 18% described their age, and that ranged from 13 to 35 years. But the average was about 18 years of age. So we can kind of get this sense that the people asking questions were rather young. Now, there was probably a lot of people like myself who were older who were just reading the questions and who follow this blog. So then myself and my team, we really wanted to look at what were motivating people to ask questions. And we really sort of saw this clear breakdown in the motivation of these groups. And unfortunately, something happened to my percentage, but the majority, about 30%, they really wanted to know these questions about, am I normal? So I have a question about vaginal discharges. I know it's normal to have discharges, but is it normal to have them every single day? So a lot about, hey, this is my body, or this is a process that's going on with it. Is that normal? Second was what we sort of termed the tell me more at 29%. And this was, they just wanted a little bit extra information about a topic, or they wanted to know the opinion of the individuals who ran this blog. So, for example, what are your thoughts on eating while in labor? Following that at 26% were individuals who were looking for some sort of second opinion. So they had interacted with a healthcare provider, and either they didn't get enough information, it was vague, or they really weren't quite sure about the information they got, so they were really looking for this sort of second opinion. So for example, I'm 13 weeks pregnant, my doctor is a bit vague because she doesn't want to worry me, but she said X, Y, and Z. And then finally, our final category with, I believe about 18%, was this myth-busting category. So this is where a lot of people were asking, you know, my friend told me this, is it true that such and such is going on? So for example, my friend said you can still have one full period even if you're pregnant. Is that true? So these were sort of the motivations behind why people were asking questions. And then we wanted to break down, well, what were the content areas about what was being asked? And there were 57 different topics, and they weren't mutually exclusive. Many times people asked multiple questions. But if this is a chart just showing the ones that had over 10 questions each. And of course, our runaway train is about birth control. A lot of the questions regarding birth control had to do with effectiveness. So I heard that your body gets used to oral contraception. Is that true? And that it's not as effective over time. The side effects with different types of contraceptives. Whether or not it affects long-term fertility. I heard that the IUD may prevent you from having children later in life. Whether or not people should change their birth control, depending on, you know, a lot of different things going on in their lives. And then procedural knowledge. So I take my oral contraceptive at 9 a.m., but I want to switch to 9 p.m. How do I do that and not put myself at risk for unintended pregnancy? The second one was menstruation. So a lot of questions about individuals having irregular periods. What do they do about that? Heavy bleeding, painful cramping, and just the lack of knowledge about, you know, just usual reproductive processes. And then the third sort of biggest content area was in regards to abortion. So how to access this, where can I go to access an abortion, how much does it cost, legal issues. I'm 17. Do I have to notify my parents? Questions about whether or not an abortion now would affect future pregnancies. Lots of questions surrounding emotions related to abortions. I had an abortion and I don't regret that. Is that normal? I had an abortion and it was the right choice, but I'm sad about it. What should I do? And then some short-term medical side effects, so cramping, bloating, fevers related to that procedure. So those were the top three, but as you can see, there was a lot more. And these are just the top, the sort of content areas that had at least 10 question answer. So this adds to an already robust field of inquiry about the sexual and reproductive health needs of young people. So again, there's persistent lack of knowledge, even with things like how people's bodies work. We saw that with menstruation. There are continued patient-provider communication gaps, either because they don't have access to healthcare providers or they're not getting enough information in the healthcare exchange, the communication exchange, or they're just too embarrassed to ask questions of their provider. They don't want to seem, dumb when asking questions. And then, of course, we have continued myths surrounding sexual and reproductive health issues. But this study provides, another perspective on this issue. So individuals are going to online social networks and trying to find this information. People want this information. And we have to ask ourselves, will the current climate surrounding access to sexual and reproductive information and services negatively impact health literacy related to this issue? And can we engage this population in ways that they're comfortable with, like these emerging social networks? And I wouldn't even call Tumblr an emerging social network. It's pretty established, it's well known. But can we do some of the things like an anonymous question and answer with credentialed healthcare providers? So I'd like to acknowledge my funding for travel to present here from the University of South Florida College of Public Health Student Honorary Award for Research. Here's my email address. If anybody would like to reach out to me, I'd be more than happy to discuss this at length. So thank you. Do questions.